He is the author of, oh gosh, umpteen books. I can't keep track of how many you've written now, John, but...
Over 30.
Oh, yeah. So a lot to keep track of in terms and many different series. He is not only a great author and been nominated for several Hugo Awards. Last year's Kaiju Preservation Society is up for the award. And we're so very, very lucky, John, to have our John Scalzi. Welcome.
Thank you. Is this on?
It's on.
It's on? Can you hear me? Is it actually working? Okay. Why, hello. You are the very first audience that I'm doing on this tour, and we actually kind of broke the rules a little bit to be here tonight. Usually we wait until Tuesday, which is the day that the books come out, in order to do this. But I have to go to Budapest later. I know, it's awful. And because of that, we kind of had to shift things around. And so we now here on a Monday instead of a Tuesday.
Exactly. So this is officially your book launch. We get a launch.
You are launching the book. You are launching the book a little bit early. But you know what? You guys are worth it.
I think we are. You know, we've been with you for most of your career, which is really pretty exciting.
I'm trying to think. Were you guys actually... I think... You might have been on the first book tour, which was like 2007.
We were.
Yeah.
Way back when.
So, and I remember that book tour because that was the very first time that they ever put me on a book tour. And they were worried about whether or not, you know, I could handle like being on a book tour because book tour, it's a lot, right? So I remember specifically the way that they tested to see if I could be like trusted out in public. Was they had me come to New York, and they had me come and have lunch with Jim Killian, who at the time was the science fiction fantasy buyer for Barnes & Noble. And they're like, this guy could crush your career, so if you can handle yourself well with him, then you should be fine on the road. Right, yeah. And I can get it because I'd be like, oh, you're going to please buy my book. I love you. No, whatever. I'll shine your shoes. But we just talked about jazz. So,
yeah.
And so after about 10 minutes, they're like, you're going to be fine, you know, and then and then they started telling me about, you know, being on the tour and what it was like. And I remember going on tour and they're like, okay, you're going to go here. You're going to have a media handler, to do, you know, take you from place to place. And I'm like, I am an adult. I do not need someone taking me from place to place. I so needed this person. Because after like 2 days on the road, I absolutely had no idea where I was, what I was doing, when I was supposed to be there, or anything else. It was just literally this nice woman who had done this before. She's like, okay, honey, now here's a granola bar. We're going to go to the store. You're going to sign some books. We're going to go to some other stores. You're going to sign some books there. Then I'm going to take you to the actual event. You're going to do your thing. And then we're going to take you out to dinner, okay? Then you're going to go to bed. And then you're going to go back to the airport. And I was like, oh, thank you. Because I had no idea what it drains so much out of you. Because first time you do it, it's very drained. Because I don't know if you can tell, I'm on right now, right?
Right.
And being on is fine, but as soon as you're done with it, it all just kind of goes and collapses. And I remember I was in San Francisco, and my friend Kevin Stample came to see me do the thing. And then afterwards, he went out to dinner. And he and I have known each other since we were 14, right?
Right.
So I do the event, and then we go out to dinner, and I'm just like, you're going to have to lead the conversation because I got nothing. And he was like, this has never happened. You have never once shut up. And now you want me to lead the conversation? It was the greatest day of his life up to that point, as far as he knows. It still is kind of that way. It's like, this is so much fun for me. I enjoy doing these things so much that it's just, I get such a high out of it. And then, like, the instant it's done, you know, it all collapses, right?
It's a little inside baseball, but that's why so many of us here at the store actually do the interview, is because I mean, you don't really need a lot of help.
No.
But certain authors, you know, you come on, you're doing the tour, you're on, you might be exhausted. You were up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get to the next city. You've done 6 other stops at several other stores before doing the event. And, you know, it can come and go and just flip like that. And so we're here just to sort of help lead on some of the questions and then just go from there.
Why,
you know?
Thank you. Your selflessness
hardly
is something I really appreciate. Yeah. That you are here for me.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, and it is true. It's like a lot of what happens at a particular event just depends on so many things. Like like sometimes I will do a reading, and sometimes we'll have the question and answer, or you know, sort of the back and forth. Sometimes there's another writer there, and then we will completely forget you guys are there and just like gossip for an hour, which apparently a lot of you guys like. They're like, no. Continue ignoring us. You guys are awesome. So it all depends, and that is actually not a bad thing, because it's like mixing it up makes it easier to go from day to day to day. Because I have had ones where it has always been like I'm doing a reading and I'm doing that, but even then I try to change things up. I've done enough tours now. We're being very meta. We will get to the book eventually, but I mean we're being very meta. I've done enough tours now that. I know how to mix it up. There was one tour I did, I think it was like 2 tours ago, where I brought a 10-sided die with me, and I had 10 different things that I would do, and I would just roll the dice to find out what things are going to be, you know, that evening. Like one of them was, you know, like reading from an upcoming work, a reading from something I wrote when I was in high school, a ukulele performance, you know, all of that. So she's like, yes, I want the ukulele performance. There have been times where people will show up with a ukulele and like, will you play for us? I'm like, why? You know I'm bad. They're like, yes, feature not bug, right? Like they want me to go and kind of humiliate myself with the ukulele. And so the only thing that I require for people now is that the ukulele has to be tuned before it shows up. But otherwise, you know. But
that
takes
a lot of time.
You mix it up and you do different things so that, you know, that... What you don't want is for people to come away from one of these things and be like, well, you get an event like this and be like, well, that's an hour that I wasted. And because not only have they not had a good time, but they haven't had a good time because of you, right?
Well, or you do the same thing. You know, you come once and you do the same thing and you kind of get into your...
you get into a routine.
To routine, exactly.
Right. I mean, and there's only, you know, let's be honest. I mean, there's only so much that you can do. I mean, people do not want to be like... Hi, I'm John Scalzi. I'm promoting Sortaville and through interpretive dance. And you're like, no, actually, I would be okay with that. No, you say that now, but after minute 17, right? No, it's a great 3-second bit. 5 minutes? No, you don't want that.
I'm really proud of the people who sit up the front of the audience, because usually we, you know, if we have a smaller crowd, they always sit in the back like we're a Gallagher concert.
Yeah. You will get wet. No, I mean, I've always been, and again, we're continuing to be meta here. Welcome to meta event. I've always been fortunate that the people who show up to my things, they don't want to be in the back. They're like, I'm right up here in front. I'm going to look at you right here. How are you doing? You know, that sort of thing. There's something about me that basically... neon flashing light over my head, harmless, right? Yeah. It's like, oh, you can get close to him. He's not going to bite. He's fine. He's nice. We like him.
Until you interpret it dance and we give you your ketchup and mustard bottle, right? To squeeze and...
You know, the irony is that paint. I could absolutely 100% do interpretive dance. I took 2 years of jazz and modern in high school, right? I absolutely did. He's like, thank you. And I remember Jordan Rodak, my high school dance teacher, just basically came up to me my junior year and is like, we have no boys in the dance class. I need a boy. You're that boy. And she walked away, and I was like, well, I'm not going to argue with Jordan Rodak. She's a dancer. She could snap off my head with her leg, you know. And it was great because, as you know, as a heterosexual straight white boy, I learned how to dance and not be self-conscious about the fact that I was dancing, which was incredibly helpful many years later when I was working at a newspaper and I was doing a story about a local DJ. And while the DJ was doing a nighttime event, I was just like, hey, would you like to dance? Would you like to dance? Because I just wanted to dance. Unbeknownst to me, the woman who would become my wife was there that night. She saw, with her date, she saw me dancing, and then later on, I'm like there with my Coke, just minding my own business, and literally the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life, and I was interviewing movie stars at the time, so I had a bar that was pretty high. The most beautiful woman I've ever seen came up to me and was like, I saw you dancing out there. You and I have to dance sometime tonight, to which I said, now is good. And we danced and blah, blah, blah. And then we eventually, you know, got married. And then, but later on, like I brought her down to meet all my friends from high school for the very first time. And of course they were wowed by Chrissy because how could you not be? And as she went off to go get a beer or something, they all were like, we don't understand. And I'm like, what don't you understand? We don't understand how you managed that. I was like, you know how I did it? Because I was the one who learned to dance. And now all of you are sad and alone. And I've got her. Anyway,
speaking of...
Yes, where's your segue from that? Let's
exactly.
go.
Exactly.
I want to know what this segue is.
Well, you know, speaking of, so you danced with her, and then later on you decided to buy a church with her.
We bought a church, yes. We did buy a church. That is a very interesting segue. There's 30 years between the two of those things. We recently bought a church. I want to be very clear. I see the look of confusion right here. I want to be clear. I am not starting a cult. There's a bad track record there with science fiction writers.
I asked in the back, too, just in case.
No, literally, but you know, this is the thing. It's like we'd say to people, it was like, we bought a church. And they're like, why? And, you know, they're like, just want to be clear. What is the, you're not going to, like, become ministers or something. I'm like, well, you know, technically we actually are ordained. And people are like, what? Because my wife and I are both ordained so that we can marry friends off, because we, you know, a lot of them didn't have a religious tradition and they didn't know if they were going to get anyone to like marry them. They didn't just want some random person to marry them. So they're like, we'll do it. We're going to be there anyway, you know, at the wedding. So we have both married off a number of people. But we bought the church because we wanted office space, right? I have a basement that's a fire trap of books, both my own, because I, you know, I get lots of author copies, but I also get lots of author copies from foreign languages. And then I get a whole bunch of books sent to me because they're for the big idea or to, you know, with the new books and arcs thing that we do. And so they just pile up. And so we needed space, someplace to put all those books. Plus we wanted office space, because we have some plans. And if we actually hire people, we don't want them to come to our house because it's our house. So we were looking for office space, and we thought that we were going to just have to buy some land and build a pole barn and put an office in there. But literally I went looking for land and the church went up for sale like 3 hours earlier. And so this is a church that we had gone by in our little village all the time. We went in and looked at it. My wife's job is an insurance claims adjuster. She actually like can look at your roof and tell you what happened to the roof, which is amazing. And which is awesome because we will just be like driving down the road and she's judging roofs as we go by, and you can see it in her eyes. She's like, really? That's the roof you went with? Well, that was a choice, you know, that sort of thing, right? So she literally crawls through this building. She's like, this needs work because it's an 80-year-old church, but it's solid. We should buy this and make it a project. And so that's what we ended up doing. We bought the church for office space, not a cult, And we've spent the last couple of years renovating it, and we've finally gotten all the renovations done. We've moved stuff in, and it's absolutely beautiful.
I love what you have on the altar.
Oh, what I have on the altar of the church, not a cult. So I have this guitar, and it is called the Beast. Who doesn't know what the Beast is? Anyone raise your hand. Okay, wait a second. Now I got to actually, like, pull up the picture. You will have to squint, but you will, once you see it, you can't unsee it. All right, here we go. So it is, to be clear, this is a guitar with six necks. And each of the necks is a completely different guitar. You have a 12-string guitar. You have a 6-string with a Floyd Rose tremolo. You've got a 5-string bass. You've got a 4-string bass. You've got a 7-string guitar for when you want to do the heavy metal. And then we have another 6-string, but that 6-string is a baritone guitar. So, yes, I know the question is, why? Why? Why is it? Because my COVID project was a music room, and so when I looked at it, I saw it online that it was being auctioned off, and I looked at it, and I'm like, that would be awesome for my music room. And I want to be clear that when I say that my COVID project was the music room, I'm not saying that my COVID project was music. No, it was the acquisition of musical instruments, and this is not the only thing that I bought that was, like, really bizarre. I will just have you know. But it's just, but that is the one where I show it to people and they're like, why do you exist? What was even the thought there? And I bought it as art, right? As a centerpiece. And so, but now we have a church. What better to put on the altar than the Beast? So now it's there, and this is the only thing that I'm worried about, that when we do the open house for the community, because the community is fascinated to find out what we are doing with this place that they went to church at and had weddings at and funerals and Sunday school, that they will come in the very first day, and there's the Beast. And like, I'm sorry, now we have to burn you in oil.
I was going to say, what better way than starting a heavy metal hymnal?
Heavy metal hymnal. Ooh. So my wife actually just threw me a surprise birthday party, not for me, but for my blog, which turned 25 this last week. And so she actually, like, got friends from all over to come and come to the church, and she threw me a surprise birthday party. And that was a combination surprise birthday party for the blog and an excuse for her to show off to all our friends the church. And in the pews where the hymnals used to be are first editions of, like, all my works. So, and I was like, I went up there and I'm like, oh, this is so sweet. This is awesome. No, you can't take it.
We just saw coming through a first sign for, well, you just signed.
I just
a first
signed.
Edition of Old Man's War.
Yeah, Old Man's
and
War.
That is a beautiful book.
So Old Man's War, first edition. So it came out on January 1st, 2005, right? Because as we know, January 1st is the best time to release any book. The first printing was 3,700 hardcovers. And they burned through those. If memory serves, they burned through them in like a couple of weeks. And then there was a brief period of time where you couldn't buy a copy of the book for love or money. They caught up, and, you know, we've sold quite a few since then, but those 3,700 they're really hard to find now, because a lot of them went to libraries. So they just don't exist anymore, because they've just been read to tatters. People just like, well, it's a book, and, you know, just didn't pay attention to them. So if you have one, it's worth just blank $200 or $300 right now, and it'll only go up in time. And so whenever people give me the book to sign, I will always check the hardcover. I will always check to see which printing it is. And if it's the first printing, I'm like, okay, you have a choice. I could just sign it, or I can put your name in it. And people want to have it personalized, but I'm like, when I die, This is going to be worth so much more if you don't have it personalized. Either way, I will do whatever you want. And I don't care what you do with it after I'm dead, because I will be dead. So you tell me, do you want me to personalize it, or do you just want it signed? And you can see the cogs. They're like, I don't want to offend him, but I also like money. And then they just ask for the flat sign, which is fine because that's like literally what I would do, right? It's right. Like, no, don't do it to me. Just sign it. And then don't pay attention to the bear that I've hired outside.
Years ago, we had the Cuckoo's Calling that came out, and we had a handful signed in from the UK.
Right, right.
Robert Galbraith.
Right, right, right.
And our store owner's like, this book's too good to be a first-time novelist.
Sure.
So she asked the British publisher, is this, I'm going to choose this as a first novel book club. But I have to be guaranteed this is not just a very established author, because I think it's too polished to be. And as it turns out, yeah. They
lied through their teeth.
They lied through their teeth because it was supposed to be a secret. And then, of course, the book bombed and the name leaked.
Yeah.
And it was J.K. Rowling. Yeah. And those books went from, because they did a small print run, from what we sold it to people for $36 went up to 10 grand overnight.
Yep. Yep. I don't have a pen name, so you don't have to worry about that. Nobody knows anything, right? I mean, and I certainly don't mean this as any disrespect to Tor, not just because my editor is literally in the room right now, but I mean, releasing the book on January 1st was just basically, we're throwing this up and seeing if it sticks, right, sort of thing. And that was fine because there were like three or four or five other. It was a Tuesday. Tuesdays mean the book comes out. There's always a book out on Tuesday. And nobody knew. Nobody knew what was going to happen to that. I know that Tor liked the book. I mean, they bought it. I know that Patrick liked the book because Patrick told me he liked the book. His exact words, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, he says, this is the exact sort of 2.5 dimensional character stuff that we just can't get enough of. And he was 100% correct. It was exactly what that book was. And I didn't have any expectations for it. I remember when I sold Old Man's War to Tor, and Chrissy, my wife, was like, so what does this mean? I was like, it means nothing. It means that every couple of years, if I'm lucky, I will be able to publish a book. I might go to a convention every once in a while and it will make my money. But every once in a while, I get to put out a book. And how cool is that? Right. So that was literally the plan. It was like every two or three years, we'll get a book out. And then, of course, Old Man's War took off.
Huge.
It sold out super quickly. Tor saw what it had and really backed it. Really backed it and came to me and said, we want you to write the sequel, get to it. And I was very fortunate that they recognized it, that they supported me. They have continued to support me. And again, not just because my editor's in the room right now, but literally the support I've had from Tor all through my career has been the sort of thing that you dream of. And because of that, it became the thing where I stopped doing all that consulting and freelance work and became a full-time novelist. I never expected that to happen. Nobody knows. Nobody expects that. I tell people I'm an accidental novelist, and they're like, right. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. My plan was literally to work in newspapers my entire life. I got my first job was a film critic at the Fresno Bee newspaper in Fresno, California. And then I also got a column. And I had wanted to be a newspaper columnist all my life. I was like, I grew up literally like reading Mike Royko and Molly Ivins and, you know, all those great newspaper columnists. And I'm like, that's what I want to do. And so suddenly become a full-time novelist. Okay.
You know, but you earned your writing chops through writing for the newspapers.
Oh.
I mean, it hones you to become a novelist, whereas a lot of novelists, you know, it's their first book. And then they get the book deal, and then it's, you know, one book every year. You're sort of used to that sort of writing grind.
One of the things that I feel very fortunate about, quite honestly, as a novelist, was, in fact, the whole thing of the journalistic training. Because one thing, it absolutely deromanticizes writing, right? It's like nobody cares how you feel. You got a story done, and it needs to be in by 3 p.m. because 3 p.m. is the drop-dead deadline. Everything has to be to production at 3 p.m. If it's not in at 3 p.m., it's not going in, right? It's not going to be in the newspaper. And if it's not in the newspaper, why are you here, right? So you get used to just... I know someone who's a journalist, and I see him back there, and he's smiling. He's like, yep, yep, that's exactly right. But and so it gets you over the thing of, oh, I need my precious muse. It's like, no, I need to actually just get this thing done. And so being able to write quickly and being able to write succinctly, being able to write cleanly so that a copy editor doesn't come over and strangle you, which I've literally had happen to me in the newsroom, was all these important things. Journalism really was useful in becoming a first-time novelist and continuing to be a novelist. Also, the ability to research. Also, dialogue and having people talk to each other and stuff. Although, you know, that came from other places as well. A lot of who I am as a novelist comes originally from who I was as a journalist.
One of the things I love about your books is that you world build without a lot of extraneous information. We're not, you know, given six chapters and world building. You're world building as you go.
Okay, but I'm gonna counterpoint that with the fact that the guys who do six chapters of extraneous world building, they sell 10 times what I do because people dig that stuff. Like, they want to know all the details. What kind of cloth were they wearing? Who were the people who weaved it? You know, where did they get that color? Was it from a crushed rock? Did they get it from a flower? And which flower? At what height? On which mountain? They want to know all of that stuff. And that's why you get those epic fantasy books that could stun an elk because they're that big. And people are like, there's not enough. And that's why they have 10 or 15 books in the series, because it's all there. And people are like, I could cosplay that shit for days. Nobody cosplays me. No, I take that back. I was at SoonerCon this year. One guy cosplayed the people, someone from the Kaiju Preservation Society, and he was just wearing coveralls that said KPS on it. And he's like, well, you didn't really describe it, so.
You know?
So, I mean, I knew it was, because he said, look, it says KPS. I was like, no, I see that, thank you. But meanwhile, his companion was dressed like Death from, you know, Sandman. She was stunning, and it was perfect, because you're like, yeah, nope, that's Death right there. Got it all. You got that up 115%. So what I'm going to say is, you're right. I do my world building in a very specific way that doesn't rely a lot on description, but that doesn't mean I'm doing it right. It just means I do it in a particular way. And all of those people who are like, oh, no, let me tell you, all 15 courses of the meal, plus which one was poisoned, they're doing it right, too, for their particular audience.
I could see somebody cosplaying Hera in this book.
Oh, yes. Spoiler, Hera is a cat. There was one time, and it was at Lost Con, and I think it was 2008, where someone came in and cosplayed as my cat Fluffy, who is famously known as Bacon Cat, because I tape bacon to my cat. For all of you who are just who are new to me, I'm sorry, I'm weird. But yeah, she came in and she cosplayed as my cat, and so she looked like a Siamese cat or a Himalayan cat because that's what Fluffy was, and had a bacon sort of scarf, and it was a deeply confusing time in my life. So I'm not sure that I'm ready for people to cosplay as cats that I know. It was, yeah. Anyway.
But Hera is a very specific cat.
Yeah. No, I mean, Hera is, I mean, without getting too many spoilers, because I don't know how many of you have read the book yet, because it's literally not officially out yet. You are the first. When we first meet Hera, Hera just seems like a normal, everyday cat, but it becomes very quickly apparent that there's much more to her than meets the eye.
Well, the reason why I bring her up is because a mutual writing friend of ours has a very interesting cat as well that you based Hera off of.
It's so Mary Robinette Cole, who is a wonderful writer, who's nominated for the Hugo this year for The Spare Man, which is a wonderful book. I fully expect to be happy for her when she wins and I lose. She has a cat, Elsie, and she has these button boards. And the button boards are designed so that they have words and stuff like that. And so the cat will hit the buttons in certain sequences, and then they can have a conversation. And so now the question is, does the cat actually understand syntax, or is the cat just hitting buttons, like knows that one button means food and one button means out and one button means pet, and then whatever other buttons get punched is Mary Robinette or anybody else, like, I am spinning context around that. My cat is smart, right? And I think it's hard to say, right? You know,
right.
It's really hard to say because if you've ever had a pet, you know that the interior life of the pet is fairly complex, even though, you know, they're not doing calculus. I mean, actually, cats do calculus when they're, like, jumping and stuff like that. It's all, you know, as part of their, you know, internal systems, but they're not like sitting there going, what is the cosine and how should I jump in order to disembowel that rodent? But yeah, they have rich interior lives. Like every single one of my cats has a very distinct personality, has very distinct ways of expressing themselves. Same with my dog, you know? To say that they're not smart is wrong, but they're not smart in the way that we are smart. We valorize our type of intelligence because we have clothes and cars and books and stuff like that, and all they have are disemboweled rodents. But who is happier? It's not the rodent. The rodent loses in every situation. But so yeah, you know, I look at Elsie or I look at the other, you know, animals that are really smart. I remember there was a dog that knew 1,000 words. Like you could specify, go get me the blue octopus from the green box. And they would go and do it, you know, within the constraints of them being able to see colors at all. And like the dog knew exactly what was going on and understood what was being said. And right. That was an exceptional dog. So it's entirely possible that cats do have the ability to communicate and have interior lives and do all that sort of stuff, and that it wouldn't be a jump from a button board to actual communication. Although, you know,
in Starter Villain, we've got a cat that can communicate a little bit more. She's a little bit more complex in her language skills.
Yeah, she's good at interpretive dance.
Yes, she is.
This is the fun thing about, and now we're going to talk about the book a little bit. Wait, we're only a half hour in. What?
That's all right.
34 minutes in. I'm sorry. We've gone all over the place, haven't we? One of the fun things about this book is, like, so for example, everybody knows supervillains have cats, right? Like you think Blofeld and his white Persian, right, or you know any of the any of that sort of stuff. Or did you ever see the movie Bolt?
Oh, it's a great movie.
It's a great movie. Underrated Disney movie. Absolutely, it's great. It's very meta, which is a thing that I really like about it. It's got a great soundtrack, including some wonderful songs by Jenny Lewis. But one of the things that the cats are all on the side of evil in that, you know, and that plays into the course of the story where Bolt the dog thinks that his girl has been absconded by the green-eyed man, and just finds some random cat and is like, "You guys are disgusting. It's in your genes, you know," and all that sort of stuff. And the cat's like, "I know, we're evil. What are you gonna do?" So the cats are part of the trope. There are other supervillain tropes. Supervillains always have volcano lairs, you know, that sort of thing. But the thing that this book was fun for me to write was not about the tropes per se, right? Like volcano lair, we've seen the volcano lair. We've seen it in the Bond movies. We have seen it in The Incredibles. You know, we've seen it all over the place. But from a practical point of view, why would you have a volcano lair? Why would anybody want to guess? Raise your hand. Why would you have a volcano lair? Yes? No! I mean, yes, but geothermal energy. Thank you very much, sir. You're very handsome. It makes sense because you have all this unlimited energy to do all your nefarious plans with. You know, it's not like you have the volcano lair because it's cool, sir, because they can see the volcano lair now. They've got satellites overhead. It doesn't matter how cool it is when the CIA can just drop a bomb on it. But now you have a reason to have it. Why do you have the cats in this book? There's an actual reason to have the cats in the book. It's doing all the things, talking about all the tropes, and making them just plausible enough that you can spin this story that seems to have some relationship to reality outside of the context of the 2 hours of a James Bond movie. Have you ever thought about like all the villains that they come up across, right? And all the nefarious plans? What is never said, because it doesn't have to be said, because they're always defeated at the end, is the now what, right?
Right.
Like, what happens after Spectre takes over the world or all of these things happen? These are not good administrators, right? They're not the people who are like, and now I will have this bureaucracy that will take care of the day-to-day lives of all the people who are now subjugated under me. They literally don't do that. Literally the only time that this is even addressed in any sort of supervillain sort of way is in Superman 2, where Zod gets the president to kneel before him and becomes the ruler of the world and immediately gets bored. Right?
Right.
Because there was no end game after like taking over the world. They had nowhere to go after that. And I remember in the movie, and I may be misremembering because it's been 40 years since I've seen it, where he's like, "I rule the world today." And then one of the henchmen says, "Yes, and you will rule it tomorrow too." And they're sad because there's nowhere to go. It's like someone comes in, it's like, "Well, what are we going to do about the harvest, sir?" You know, there's no future in any of it. And so what I wanted to do was to imagine the world where the "and what then" actually gets answered in context of one of these books.
One of my favorite characters in this are your sentient dolphins.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not going to spoil it because I don't want to, but it is one of the funniest scenes. I had milk coming out of my nose, I think, at a couple points.
Spoiler, they swear. You know, the thing is, though, this is another thing about taking what we know and then spinning it. Like, when I was growing up, when I was a wee lad, we all thought that dolphins were cute, right? That they were the adorable, cuddly, plush things of the sea. They're fucking evil. They are the things that they do to other sea creatures.
Well, and there's questions and, of
there's,
when,
no,
yeah, the SeaWorld.
They're yeah, well, you know, it's yeah. the we're not good to them, but they're bad people anyway, right? That's independent. We should not be doing what we do to these animals, and also, holy crap, they're awful, right? So, you know, you have those two things, and you have both of those things together, the exploitation of cetaceans and the fact that they're jerks, and that comes together in the book. And that is all, don't worry, the alien will not come down and eat you. Probably. But yeah, bringing those two things together in the context of the book and being able to play with the things that we know and that we understand and hopefully bring something new and compelling into it in terms of the story structure.
What I love is this is sort of just you having fun, just like Kaiju was you having a lot of fun.
The Kaiju Preservation Society.
Preservation Society, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, yes, absolutely. The secret of the matter is I am a very cruel reader, cruel, C-R-E-U-L, not cool, C-O-O-L. I've never been cool. But in the sense of if I'm not immediately entertained, I will just put the book down because especially now I'm 54 years old. There are only so many more books that I'm going to read. I'm not going to waste my time with one that's like, oh, if you wait another 7 chapters, it gets really good. It's like, no. I'm 7 chapters closer to death. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to put it down and I'm going to read something else. But the way that I feel about other people's book, I feel 10 times more about mine. If I am bored writing it, oh my God, you're going to be so bored right. reading it. And so I try to make them funny. Now that doesn't mean that everything has to be like yada, 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 da, 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 da. You know, it's not all just hit it, hit it, hit it, hit it. You have to develop the story and the peaks and valleys and everything else like that. But at all times it needs to be readable. It needs to bring it forward. And if I'm laughing when I'm reading my own jokes, that's helpful. If I am crying when I've got the sad parts, then that's helpful as well. And so all of those things, I want it to be fun, especially if the book's meant to be fun. So yeah, absolutely. That said, it's not all happiness and traipsing through the roses. I got COVID while I was writing this book. I don't know if you know, there's this disease. It's been kind of doing a number on all of us. And so I got COVID, and I have to say again, when I reported in, I was like, yep, I got COVID. Patrick, my editor, was like, don't overwork your brain because this just won't work, right? Take some time off. And I was like, my editor's telling me not to work? Okay. So I spent a month not doing anything. Which was hard. nobody believes that. But then after a month, I was like, okay, now it's time to start writing again. And then I wrote straight for a month. And then after that month, the actual COVID fog lifted. And then I read what I had written that month. It's like, oh no. Oh no, that's not right at all. Oh, no, no one will ever see this. And so I had to revamp what I was doing and how I was doing it. So this was fun to write, but not every part of it was fun. The yeah. actual having 2 months where the thing you do for a living is a thing that you can't do at all, that's a little existentially concerning. And so, yeah, so that was a thing. Kaiju is another perfect example. I've talked about this before. Kaiju, I was supposed to be writing another book entirely, right? And it didn't work because I was trying to write a dark, gritty political thriller in 2020, and that was the wrong year to try to do that. And it just didn't work at all. And I eventually had to like send an email to Patrick being like, my God, I couldn't get it done. And I hate this book and I hate the way it makes me feel. And he was like, that's fine. We've already gotten the cover art, but that's fine. And that's right. Yes. He's like, oh, yes. That was yes. Money down the tubes. And so, but I went and took a shower when he told me I was excused and we'd figure something out. And that's when the whole plot of Kaiju Preservation Society plopped in my brain. And I wrote it in 5 weeks and I got it in. And people were like, that's amazing. You wrote a book in 5 weeks. I was like, no. I wrote a book in 5 weeks plus the year that I couldn't write that other book. Kaiju is a great book. Well, not a great book. It's a good book. It's a very good book. And, you know, I'm very proud of it, and I'm very proud that it exists at all. But I don't want to experience the experience I had of not writing just to have something come up at the end. So there's fun, yes. All fun all the time? No.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that I really loved about Kaiju, and one of my coworkers here, she's reading it right now, and she said, so is Jamie a man or a woman? And I said, yes. So I love the fact that you give us the ability to think of some of your characters and dealing with some of your characters in a way that just leaves it up for us for interpretation.
Sure. I mean, the what we're talking about here, Jamie, who is the protagonist of Kaiju Preservation Society, I never mention the gender. Because for what I was doing, it wasn't necessary. And whenever that gets mentioned, there's always people who have read the book. They're like, what? Right? Because, unless you're really paying attention to it, it doesn't show up. Now, this doesn't mean that I get roses and cookies for having a non gender specified character. What it means is that for what I was doing, I didn't think the gendering was particularly relevant, so I didn't put it in. Now, there are other characters in the book that are non-binary. There are other characters who, you know, are across the range of sexuality and identity and stuff like that. And those are there specifically because I live in a world where there are people who are trans and who are non-binary and who are gay and bi and pan and all these other sort of stuff. They literally exist in my world every day. There are people that I like and there are people that I love. So why wouldn't I have them in the books that I write as well? And more than that, in the particular case of Kaiju, when characters are non-binary or when they are, you know, have this whatever sexuality they have, the book doesn't stop to be like, and I'm bi, you know, or and I'm, you know, everybody understands that that's part of the world that they exist in. They've got other things that they're talking about, mainly large monsters. Exactly. And they go on from there. Because again, you know, that's part of the world that I live in and also part of the world that I think that I should live in. So that's what I do.
Exactly. And I just love your treatment of character, you know, and the fact that you're willing to, like you said, you're not willing to stop just for that. It's part of who they are.
Yeah.
It's not what makes them a whole person. Which I really enjoy. And I think that that's really cool. And in this book, in Starter Villain, you're giving us Charlie dealing with a very complicated relationship. You know, how do you deal with your uncle, who is a supervillain?
Right. Well, and I think more importantly with this, I mean, supervillain part's kind of cool, right? It's the thing that you didn't know about someone that you were related to. But I also, it was about the fact that here was this person who is not in Charlie's life for years and years and years and years and years, right? That there was family drama there. There was a whole thing going on. And then all of a sudden Charlie is the heir apparent, mm-hmm. right? And so the question is, what is going on? What is the actual relationship? What was it ever supposed to mean, you know? And what does it, how does it play out to how Charlie feels about it? And there are a couple scenes in the book, like there is a scene where he goes and to his uncle's funeral, and before anybody else is let into the viewing room, he has a couple minutes with his uncle, who the last time he saw he was 5 years old, and he's thinking about who his uncle was and what he, you know, all that, what that relationship meant to him, And the ambivalence and also kind of a little bit of the confusion there, you know, is something that I wanted to capture because, you know, when you, you know, you have like a family member who you've never known, and all of a sudden it's supposed to be really important, that becomes a whole thing. I'll give an example from my own life that's kind of on point, which is I didn't know I had a brother until I was 12 years old. My mother had a baby boy when she was a teenager back in the 60s when that was not done. And so the baby was put up for adoption, was never spoken about until literally a month before we met him, where my sister came up to me and said, "Did you know we have a brother?" And I was like, "Do we?" And then I said to my mom, "Mom, do I have a brother?" And she goes, "Yeah, but you'll never meet him." And a month later, he's like, "Hi, here I am." Turns out my mother and his mother were part of the same social club. And not only did they know each other, a month before, because she didn't know the relationship between him and my mom, not only did they were they talking about their kids, my mother with my sister and his mother with him, they were stunned at how similar the issues that they were having with their children were. It's like, wow, they could be related. Surprise! And so at 12 years old, to find out that here's this 16-year-old brother that you didn't know you had, and now here he is, that was a really weird moment in my life, right? Because part of my identity was I'm part of this family, and now all of a sudden, you know, here's this other person. He is part of our family. He became part of our family. But it was like that was a weird transition. In the same sort of way, what was going on with Charlie is like now he is part of his uncle's life, even though his uncle's dead, and having to fit that into his own identity and his idea of who his uncle was, because he always thought his uncle was, you know, a parking garage king. And to discover that there was this whole other side to him was another aspect entirely.
I think that is classifying for starter villain or super villain anyways being a parking...
The parking garage guy. Yeah. Well, that was cool. Again, the idea of giving everything sort of this sheen of plausibility, right? It's like you never think about parking garages. Who thinks about parking garages? But not only do people think about them, there's like it's in the book. There's an actual trade magazine for parking garages, Parking Monthly or whatever it is called. It really exists. This is a multi-billion-dollar business and it's cutthroat, you know, and you don't ever think about it because you just need some place to park. But there's a whole bunch of stuff going on under the surface there. And that is part of the fun of writing these books is to, like, I spent a good day learning about parking garages, right? Mm-hmm. And the whole business of parking garages. I learned more than I needed to know because when I wrote about it, I wanted to make sure that, you know, it sounded like I knew what I was talking about. Even if all it was really like, he's a parking garage guy. And they were, you know, when we brought someone in to talk about parking garages, he's the guy who is a reporter for Parking Garage Magazine. It exists. Look it up. And that was fascinating. The other sorts of research that you do, and I was talking about this the other day with someone, that what is fun about doing research, particularly with books that are sort of modern books or contemporary books, because this takes place in contemporary time, is finding the little bits that only a few people are ever going to get. For most people, it's just background color, but for the people who know, it's like, oh my God. So, like, for example, and again, I'm nerding out here. So Barrington, Illinois, is a suburb of Chicago. It plays a role in the book. And so one of the things that Charlie wants to do is he wants to buy this pub. And it's on a particular corner, all that sort of stuff. That pub, under a very slightly different name, exists. And when I was writing it, that pub was up for sale. And not only was that pub up for sale, the one that he wants to buy, it was up for sale for the exact amount that he's trying to get a loan for, right? Mm-hmm. All of this stuff. And like I said, nobody is going to know this except like two people in Barrington where they're going to be like, holy shit. He knew. How did he know? Oh. Or with Kaiju, there's another example of this. I'm so proud of this, actually. So Kaiju, there, everybody who's going to go to the Kaiju Preservation Society boards a plane that goes, leaves Baltimore and goes to the Thule Air Force Base, which is up in Greenland, right? There is, in fact, an actual weekly flight from BWI to Thule Air Force Base. Always leaves at exactly the same time, which is like 2 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday, and always lands right around 8 o'clock and stuff like that. So when I was doing the book, it takes place between March 2020 and March 2021. I actually had the schedule of days of which days everything was going on. So on the day that they flew to Thule Air Force Base, I went online and I looked up the historical weather data for Thule Air Force Base for that particular day and that particular time, so that when they got off the plane, what they were seeing was what anybody at Thule Air Force Base would have seen, right? And again, nobody cares. But two people who were at Thule Air Force Base at the time would be like, oh my God, was he here? How did he know? And then they will like look around in their pictures trying to see if I was there, kind of going like, or something like that. These little bits of research that you get to do as a writer to give what you're doing for similitude is some of the most fun that you get to do.
Exactly. Pieces of color that are just there. They may just always be there for you, but they add a level of depth.
Right. They add that level of, no, I could see this happening in the real world. Like I said, nobody cares about the weather in Thule, but I do. And knowing that that was giving that amount of grounding made that book, I think, that much better.
So do we have any?
It's why it won. It's why it was nominated for the Hugo. the weather in at Thule Air Force Base.
Do we have any questions for John?
Raise your hand. Yes. Okay. Question about Collapsing Empire. I wanted to know why I explained the flow in the prologue and then again in chapter four. Two reasons. The first is not everybody reads the prologue. There are a lot of people who don't believe that prologues are necessary, and those people are wrong, and they should be ashamed of themselves. Particularly the way that I write prologues is to give people grounding, right? And then second of all, because the dynamics of the flow is esoteric enough that I wanted to reinforce it. So that's why it comes back again in chapter four. So there was a reason for it. Hopefully it wasn't too obnoxious for the people. I was like, wait a minute, you're just reporting yourself. Well, I get paid by the word. So I don't, in fact, get paid by the word. I don't. Any more questions? Raise your hand, please. Yes, in the Ween shirt. Yeah. Why does Arizona pop in my books? I mean, it's a state. Statistically speaking, at least 2% of the time, things would happen here. Well, like, for example, in Agent of the Stars, right, where the main character comes to visit his grandmother, who is in a retirement village in Arizona. Arizona is famously a place for retirees. You had all the Sun Cities, not the bad Sun Cities, but merely the questionable Sun Cities of Dell, whatever his name, the developer was. So what? Dell Webb, that is correct. And so they, you know, so that just kind of, it made sense that that might be someplace that she would be, right? In automated customer service, which is the Netflix episode for Love, Death, and Robots, which I wrote, the decision to actually put it in like an Arizona Sun City sort of place was actually the animators' plan, the meat department, who is the people who animated it, because they were looking at the planned communities and what they might be like 30 or 40 years in the future. And they based it off of that. And also just the geography of Arizona for something like that just is almost instantly iconic. Like the vibe that you get from just, you know, how this area looks is just kind of, it's kind of amazing, actually. I will say, I love coming here, not just because you're all wonderful people, but also because, like, for example, like I stay over at the, often stay at the Hotel Valley Ho, right? Which is just this, like, mid-century sort of fantasia, and it's kind of amazing. And so the whole, like I said, the whole vibe of this area is just so specific that it's just fun to, it's fun to play with. I mean, I do other places too. Dayton shows up quite a lot because that's where I live. LA shows up a lot because I used to be a movie critic, and so I would cover LA, and I also grew up there. New York sometimes shows up. Washington D.C. shows up because, again, I lived there. Chicago shows up a lot because, again, that's some place that I had lived. So never lived here, but it's close enough, and the vibe is compelling enough to do stuff with. Other questions? Raise your hands.
Patrick, anything online?
Any questions from online? Okay. So do I have favorite covers and do I have input onto the international ones? I'll go the second first. With the international ones, we very frequently get right of refusal. Like if I don't like it, if I hate it, then I will be able to be like, no, I hate it, and they will tweak it. I don't often do that because if the person who the book designer from Romania knows the Romanian market better than I know the Romanian market, you have a Romanian book there, do you not? Or is that this is the Hungarian market? Yeah, let me see this. This is the cover for I think this is Old Man's War in Hungary, right? Which I'm going to Hungary. I'm going to Budapest. We're very very excited about that. I'll get back to that in just a minute, but. But even though I didn't like this, which I do actually, I just assumed that they know their market, that they would be like, yes, this is in fact the thing that's going to work for people buying this. So, yeah. I have to say, actually, at the moment, I love this cover for Starter Villain. And there's a lot. The thing is that people don't realize how much thought goes into a cover. Like, you're like, huh, that's a cat. That's cool. But this is not the first cat. We did some focus testing on these things. And we had some knockdown drag out discussions about what should be on this cover. And this is the one that came out because in part everybody who sees it absolutely has an opinion about it, right? And it's generally everybody's like, that's awesome. But beyond that, the functionality of this thing is amazing, right? Because for one thing, you can see this cat wherever you are in the bookstore, right? Up close, it's awesome. From far away, that's a cat. What? And you come and look at it. And the other thing is like, it's not just about the art, although the art is awesome. Tristan Elwell is the artist in question here. It did a fantastic job. But also, the flow of information on this cover, I think, is just really good. I mean, first you see the cat, right? It's amazing. Then you come up and you see the tagline, meet the new boss. And immediately, that's iconic because if you're a certain age, you know exactly where that comes from and comes from the Who. And if you don't know who the Who are, it's still awesome because that you're thinking the cat's the boss, right? What? Right. Then you go, yeah. But then the flow down here, Starter Villain, the title, New York Times International bestseller, great, John Scalzi. And for values of certain people, each of these means something important. Starter Villain, great title, if I do say so myself, because it immediately communicates what the book is about. Starter villain. It's two words. Starter villain. Four syllables. Bam, 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 bam. You know what the book's about. Like Red Shirts. Very much such a thing. You knew what Red Shirts was about. International bestseller or New York Times bestseller. Your assurance of quality. Because nobody bad.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.